Madame André. Chaudet du Plateau, Cantal, France. June 10th, 1944.
Where the hell have you been? Hubert shouts the moment I throw open the door to my bus. Bathing, and be glad for it, otherwise I'd be far less pleasant to deal with right now.
I point back out the door.
Where is everyone?
At their battle stations. They left the moment we heard the first shots.
He takes in my wet clothing and damp hair and shakes his head. Who's taking fire? I ask.
Several of Fournier's groups to the east. He went to back them up.
Dennis Rake seems to have taken up permanent residence in my bus. His radio is set right in the middle of my stump, and he's got the receiver to one ear, listening intently. Every few seconds he lifts his right hand and taps out a frantic message, then bends his ear to the receiver again.
So, I ask, what have we got?
Armageddon, Hubert says. Our scouts are reporting roughly 22,000 Boche. They say all the paths and roads are crowded with Germans and that they're supported by almost 1,000 vehicles, including tanks and armored cars, all of them armed with artillery and mortars. They've also got 10 aircraft circling the southeastern rim of the plateau and heading toward us.
When did they approach? And why didn't we see them coming?
They came in during the night, infantry first, and picked off some of our scouts. By the time we heard the vehicles, it was too late.
Hubert shakes his head, furious.
I told you it was only a matter of time.
Dennis hasn't said a word through all of this. He's kept his eyes down and is tapping furiously at his radio. What's he doing? I ask.
Trying to get through to London. We have to cancel the airdrops. There's no way we can receive them while under attack.
Hubert stands up, straps his revolver to his thigh, and walks toward the door.
Where are you going? I ask. To confer with Gaspar. Based on what I'm hearing, Fournier is already losing ground, and I want us all to be on the same page if we have to retreat.
I didn't get enough sleep. Not anywhere close to enough, in fact, and I can feel the exhaustion claw its way back into my bones.
How long before we can expect word from the others? I ask.
A couple of hours, Dennis says.
Okay, I'll be back.
Good grief, where are you off to now, Ducky?
Strawberry Field. I've got containers to unload and deliver. I can't just leave them sitting around for the Germans to confiscate in case they take the plateau. And besides, that might be the last shipment we get for a while and we're going to need every bullet. You keep trying to get through to London.
It takes 20 minutes to reach Strawberry Field, and the sight that greets me almost brings tears to my eyes. Jacques and his men are hard at work emptying the crates. I don't know whether they left when I told them to or they stayed, and I don't ask.
I could kiss you, I say, as I find Jacques beside a crate of cleaned and stacked Sten guns.
Your husband would not like that, he says without looking up.
He'd understand, given the circumstances.
Smiles are few and hard won where Jacques is concerned, but he graces me with one now.
My wife wouldn't.
Then there's nothing for it but to get to work. We finish unpacking the remaining crates and put the weapons in working order. It takes 3 hours, but soon there's nothing left in Strawberry Field except a pile of crates, and those are promptly burned. All the weapons are loaded onto flatbed trucks, and each man is given instructions on where to take them. Jacques takes 5 men and drives the heaviest artillery to Fournier and his men at the front. I take the position closest to the encampment and drive to where I can see a group of men led by the fingerless Louis and Anselm. Once they've helped me unload all the arms and ammunition, Anselm gives me a sloppy, unapologetic kiss on the forehead and thanks me. He's like a little boy let loose to play in the mud. Louis's group has an oncoming section of Germans pinned down in the valley below. They're taking heavy casualties amidst the volcanic rocks as Louis and Anselm rain down on them with Sten guns and mortars. The entire valley booms and rattles as though some small boy has been left to destroy a set of drums. I'm just about to congratulate them on their work
when a boulder 5 yards away from us explodes. I stumble backward and shield my eyes from the bits of rock flying in every direction. "Keep your eye on their fire," I shout. "That was too close." Anselm looks around, eyebrows pinched together.
"Did you come alone?"
"Yes, why?"
"Where's Jacques? Why isn't he with you?"
"Because he's taking a load to Fournier off that way," I say, pointing down the valley to the left of the Germans below us. "Besides, I can take care of myself."
I know, I just... Shit. "Nance, London will murder me if you're killed. Please get back to camp. I'm assigning someone to look after you."
The thought makes me laugh, like I need a babysitter.
"Oh, Bazooka," I say, using the nickname that I know irritates him. "I didn't know you cared."
"Whatever, just scram."
As I drive away, I notice that the shelling becomes heavier, and I worry that Louis will end up with some new body part blown off, and I won't know how to explain that to his wife. Dennis is still glued to his radio when I arrive back at the bus.
"Got through to London yet, Den?"
"Yes. I've cancelled the airdrops for tonight and tomorrow, and they've given me a time to radio back if we need another transmission. But there's more."
"What?"
"Hubert came back. He met with Gaspar and was told that it doesn't matter what we decide, he has no intention of withdrawing."
"Where's Hubert now?"
"Gone back to try and talk some sense into him again. Fournier has agreed to pull out at nightfall. We're meeting in Friedfont and then heading out in individual groups. Our rendezvous point is Saint-Saintin, 100 kilometers away."
"Merde," I hiss. "Gaspar l'enculé."
I'm afraid to ask what that means.
"It means Gaspar can shove the next red-hot poker he finds up his own arse," I say. "It's not our job to fight to the death.
Fight, yes, but fight to live another day. This war could last years. If Gaspar and his men die stupidly on this hill, we'll be crippled."
I didn't even have the chance to comb my hair after bathing, and it has dried in clumps against my skull. I rake my fingers through them now, thinking.
"Den?"
"Yeah?"
"When you get through to London next, I want you to request that they order Gaspar to withdraw. Ask that they apply leverage through de Gaulle's Free French forces. That's the only authority he feels answerable to."
"Think that will work, Ducky?"
"It better. If Gaspar won't take direct orders from de Gaulle, he won't take them from anyone."
By now, I am so exhausted that I can't take another step. I throw myself onto the bed at the back of the bus and groan. It feels as though all my muscles are separating themselves from the bones, like they're peeling away in revolt. I try to count how many hours of actual sleep I've gotten in the last 72 hours, and come up with 5. But that seems wrong. It seems impossible. How can anyone survive on so little sleep?
"Really?" Dennis asks. "You're sleeping in this ruckus?"
"At this point, I could sleep anywhere. I just need a kip or I won't be able to function at all. Wake me when you get through to London."
Dennis doesn't argue with me again, so I take off my boots and both revolvers. I loosen the belt on my trousers. The only thing that could keep me awake right now would be an armed German soldier right in front of me. Even then it might take Obersturmführer Wolf. I am asleep before I can even begin fantasizing about putting my knife against his throat. I'm woken sometime later by a gentle nudge from Dennis.
"We've got it, Ducky," he says,
and I don't miss the triumphant note in his voice.
"London has given the order for Gaspar to evacuate."
I'm up then, boots on, belt tightened, revolvers strapped in.
"Let me see it."
He hands me the message and I read it carefully.
"Will you do something for me?"
I ask.
"What?"
"Type it again, and this time sign it König." Dennis blinks at me a few times.
"As in Marie-Pierre König? De Gaulle's second in command? Why?"
"Because if we sign it De Gaulle, Gaspar will know we're bluffing. But he respects titles and authority, at least French titles and authority, and an order from König should do the trick." Dennis bends over his machine and begins typing.
"And I suppose you're going to deliver this to him?"
"I wouldn't miss the chance to see Gaspar back down for anything."
I am a bit sad to abandon my bus, particularly my mattress, but time is of the essence. I grab my pack and the little crate that came in through last night's shipment, and I say goodbye to Dennis, who is leaving to meet up with Jacques, then head to our rendezvous point at Friedfall. I watch him load his Renault with radio equipment and speed away from the encampment, and then I'm off in the truck to book Gaspar in his place. It's even more satisfying than I expected. Gaspar is a mile away atop the plateau, and it takes only a few minutes to reach his group. I march past a visibly frustrated Hubert and offer him one sly wink before handing Gaspar the message with all the pomp and circumstance due such an official communique. He reads it slowly. "König," he whispers in awe. Then he looks at me, and I don't see even the hint of suspicion in his eyes.
"When did you receive this?"
"Less than 15 minutes ago." Gaspar turns to the horizon and squints at the sun.
"We don't have much time."
And that is all it takes for the most stubborn man in all of France to begin giving the word for his men to retreat.
"We will see you in Friedfont tonight. Fournier will be waiting for us there," I say as I jog toward my truck.
"How the hell did you do that?" Hubert hisses as he trots along beside me. "Just a bit of lying and forgery. All's fair in love and war, you know."
"Where's Dennis?"
"With Jacques, on the way to Friedfont."
"Excellent. I'll see you there."
Hubert turns to his car, and I turn to the truck I've been using all day, and before long we're both speeding through two separate clouds of dust along the ridge toward Friedfont. But Hubert has the advantage of a lead foot and the little Renault, so before long I've lost sight of him. I make it no farther than the outskirts of Saint-Martial before I'm spotted by the German Henschels. I've been driving for several kilometers along the winding, exposed mountaintop road when I hear the incessant buzzing of a plane engine. 5 aeroplanes zoom above the forest in front of me, skimming the treetops, headed for Gaspar's group. Then they pass over me with a roar, and I gun the engine, trying to get as much distance between myself and them as possible. A nervous glance in the rearview mirror proves that it was indeed too much to hope that they would consider me a worthless target. One of the aeroplanes peels out of formation and circles back. It swoops around in a wide arc until it's parallel with my truck, and then accelerates. I watch the plane, knowing exactly what it's going to do, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. I have no one to fire on the plane and no good place to pull off the road, no cover to speak of whatsoever. The best I can hope for is to get farther into the valley, where it will be difficult for the Henschel to maneuver. But it's too late. The plane is in front of me once again, barreling toward me, lower now. There is a ferocious roar, and the machine gun fire on the road 50 yards in front of me. I can see the sand pop up in the little puffs as it absorbs each bullet. Merde, merde, merde! Terror is a strong thing. It comes upon you instantly and consumes all thought and reason. I cannot speed up or I will meet the gunfire sooner. I cannot veer off the road or I will find myself tumbling arse over tea kettle down the cliff into the valley below. And I cannot slam on the brakes or I will give the Henschel a sitting target. Conscious mind paralyzed, I lift my foot from the pedal and the truck slows down. Miraculously, this does the trick. The Henschel barrels toward me, firing, and the last spray of bullets stops just feet from the front of my truck as he roars overhead once more. And then I am gunning the engine, flying down the mountain road and into the valley. I have bought myself only a bit of time, however, because the Henschel has turned and is coming at me again. Only this time, it's decided to make short work of me and is approaching from behind. I can hear the screeching whine of the plane in a sharp descent. It levels out, lining my truck in its sights for a merciless strafing. I have 30 seconds at most, and my overwhelmed, exhausted brain will not tell me what to do. And that is when I see the young Maquisard standing in the middle of the road in front of me, waving his arms. "Louis?" I slam on the brakes, spitting sand all over him.
Get out, he shouts. Bazooka sent me.
One quick glance in the rearview mirror and I've thrown the car door open. Louis grabs my arm and pulls me toward the ditch before I remember something.
No, wait!
I yank my arm out of his and run back to the truck, where my pack, Sten gun, and the package I received from London are sitting on the seat. I hear the wicked popping of machine gun fire. I smell exhaust and the harsh scent of gasoline settling into the air. I grab my things and throw myself toward Louis just as the clatter of bullets hitting metal explodes around us. I am thrown none too gently into the ditch, and then all the air is knocked out of my lungs as Louis lands on top of me. His hands cover my ears, and his face is buried in my shoulder. My belongings are scattered on the ground in front of us.
What the ever-loving hell did you do that for? He screams. What is so important that you would risk your life to get it?
I would like to explain myself, but he is heavier than he looks, and my mouth flaps open and closed like a dying fish as my lungs struggle to expand. As soon as he rolls off of me, the truck explodes, and I am silenced not by lack of oxygen, but by the giant fireball that roars a few measly feet above us. The heat is immoral, something straight from the first circle of hell, and I fear it will descend on us and burn us alive. But it's gone as quickly as it came, leaving nothing behind but the faint smell of burned hair. Louis won't need a haircut anytime soon.
Quick, he says, yanking me to my feet. We need to get to the woods. He's circling back around.
Friedfeld. By the time Louis and I reach Friedfeld, our rendezvous spot has been abandoned. Given that my truck is now a burned-out shell on the side of the road, we had to make the trip on foot. And what should have taken 2 hours has taken 15 instead.
They left without us.
I look around a clearing filled with nothing but crushed grass and cigarette butts.
Not everyone.
I turn to find Anselm emerging from the tree line.
Dandan left with Fournier's group and Hubert with Gaspar's. Young Louis here was charged with making sure you arrived safely. Though I dare say the two of you could have been a bit quicker about it.
There was a bit of an incident, I tell him.
I figured you were out there courting trouble.
It was the other way around, in fact. Trouble takes great delight in courting me. But we made it.
I am pleased to see my old friend.
You stayed behind?
He grins, and the effect is quite comical given that his hair is wild and his face so dirty it looks like he's been rolling around a coal bucket.
I did say I would make sure you were looked after.
I throw myself at Anselm and give him the tightest hug I'm capable of in my exhausted condition.
Thank you, I whisper.
I pull away when I hear Louis laughing.
What?
He's got his back turned to us, his face lifted toward the plateau we've just fled.
Think about it, he says. The damn Boche are up there wondering where the hell we are. They thought we were putting up such a bloody fight because they had us surrounded. And now, they're wandering around the top of that hill scratching their heads, baffled that a group of French farmers and factory workers evaporated into thin air.
There'll be time for patting ourselves on the back later.
Anselm says, picking at a scab on his chin.
We have to get to Saint-Saintin and reconvene with the others. They've got a day's head start and a far better idea of where they're going than we do.
Louis shakes his head.
Not entirely true. I helped Fournier set up the river crossings. I know where to go.
Anselm squints at him.
River crossings?
The Germans patrol all the bridges along the river Truyère, along with any sections of the river that can be crossed on foot. For the most part, it's deep and treacherous with rapids and rocks at every turn, Louis says.
Anselm does not look encouraged. Then how are we supposed to cross?
Fournier surveyed miles and miles of river along the plateaus, looking for the most dangerous crossing points, places the Germans would never think we'd be stupid enough to try. Then we installed layers of heavy stone slabs across the river at 10 different points. They are buried 11 inches beneath the water's surface, so you can't see them from above.
All we have to do is remove our boots, roll up our pants, balance ourselves with a walking stick, which we've kept in bundles at all the crossing points, and walk to the other side.
I'll be damned, Anselm says. Then he motions to Louis. Lead the way.
The river crossing is not quite as simple as Louis made it sound. Moss has grown across the rock slabs, and in our bare feet they are as slippery as greased ball bearings. But with only a few minor wobbles, the three of us make it across without falling in the drink. And a good thing, too, because with all the spring rains and snow melt higher in the mountains, the Truyère is moving at such a ferocious clip they'd likely find our corpses bobbing in the Garabie viaduct 2 months from now.
How far from here to Saint-Satin on foot? I ask Louis once we're safely on the other side of the river.
About 4 days, he says. But only because we have to go south first, cross another mountain range, then loop our way north to avoid the German patrols. The Maquis have been separated into groups of 50 and are each taking different routes to avoid capture.
Excellent idea, I mutter. I wonder who thought of that. We take a moment to put our shoes back on and arrange our clothing. I dig around my pack, looking for a bit of food, and find a half-eaten package of biscuits and 3 squares of chocolate that I share with Louis and Anselm. Sadly, after having risked my life to save that package from Buckmaster, it contained only tea, toothpaste, and 2 cans of sardines. Louis and I ate the sardines last night for dinner. Everything else is crammed into my pack.
Ready? Anselm asks.
I suppose lying right here and sleeping for 2 days isn't an option?
Sadly, no.
Then help me up.
Saint-Saintin.
The German Luftwaffe crisscrosses the entire area during our 4-day march. Sometimes they drop bombs, hoping to hit random groups of Maquis, and sometimes they scream low over the treetops trying to flush us out. I imagine it's harder for the larger groups to avoid detection, but we just stop and rest beneath a tree until they're gone. We sleep beneath the stars, drink from streams, and eat what roots and herbs we can find this early in the summer. In desperation, one evening I eat a handful of green strawberries that I find beside a creek, then spend the rest of the evening with a bellyache. The nights are chilly and we huddle together for warmth. Finally, just after noon on the 4th day, mud-splattered and bug-bitten, we stumble into the Maquis encampment outside Saint-Saintin. The entire area is thick with trees, and the Maquis remain hidden from the German bombers beneath the sprawling canopy. Gaspar is the first to spot us. I would have liked a bit of warning before facing him. I would have liked the chance to wash my face, brush my hair, and put on lipstick. However, I root myself to the ground, straighten my back, and stare him down as he stomps toward me.
Salut, André,
he shouts across the clearing. I see a flash of teeth and think for a moment that he's ready to bite. But then I realize he is smiling. In all the months that I have dealt with Gaspar, I have never once seen him smile. The effect is rather disconcerting. I take a step back. He stands before me, nodding.
You were right, he says.
Then, before I can protest, he drops one heavy arm across my shoulders and guides me into camp. Gaspar says nothing else, but I think this is his way of communicating that he respects me, that we are comrades in arms. I'd shake him off if I didn't fear it would break this fragile truce. I need him to cooperate now more than ever. Gaspar leads me to where Hubert is lying on his back, arms behind his head, fast asleep. I kick Hubert's boots.
Wake up, this is no time for a nap.
He startles awake, takes one look at me, and leaps to his feet. Hubert is not an emotive man. He's not affectionate either. But he pulls me away from Gaspar and tight into his chest.
We thought you were dead.
Ha! It will take more than a hen shell, a blown-up truck, and a bit of machine gun fire to kill me. I'm made of sterner stuff than that, you know.
I don't even want to know, Hubert says, throwing his hands up. Good, because I'm too starving and exhausted to explain.
What do you have in the way of food around this place?
Absolutely nothing.
Haven't you radioed for provisions?
About that, Ducky, Dennis Rake says.
I turn to find him, hands stuffed in pockets, looking rather abashed.
I had to bury my radio and transmitter before we left Friedfall.
Why the bloody hell would you do a thing like that?
He greets me with a friendly kiss on the cheek. Protocol, darling.
What about the codes?
Chewed them into paste and swallowed them.
Are you saying that we are a 4-day hike from where London believes us to be, with no means of communication and no way to feed or continue to arm 7,000 French resistance soldiers?
What I'm saying, Ducky, is that we are absolutely, catastrophically buggered without a radio.
Lucienne Callier, Garde de Marseille Blancard, December 7th, 1942. As the occupation has worsened, the daughters of France begin fighting back in their own way. For every 10 German men who have poured into the Côte d'Azur, 3 German women have followed. Wives, girlfriends, lovers, all of them eager to escape the shambles of their own country and take advantage of the beauty and luxury of Marseille. The French hate these impostors, of course, and do everything possible to make their lives a living hell. Observing that most French women go without hats, the officers' wives stop wearing them as well. Within days, the women of Marseille rally and begin wearing hats again. But determined to thumb their noses at the housefrous, they all stick green feathers, nicknamed les haricots verts, a rude term for the Germans, in the bands, and walk head high, knowing their rivals will not follow suit, because now simply wearing a hat is to spit at the Third Reich. However, the daughters of France save their deepest ferocity for fellow countrymen who choose to collaborate with the Germans. The men are categorically ignored, on the street and in the bedroom, which is considered to be a fate worse than death to a Frenchman. But it is the women who are found to be in league with the Germans who are treated ruthlessly. They are shaved bald and thrown into the streets with a swastika painted on their foreheads in red lipstick. It marks them as traitors on sight. A shameful excommunication. I, for one, am delighted to see green feathers sprouting from every hat in the train station this morning. Sometimes we need to see that we are not alone.
Why do I let you do this? Henri mutters into my neck as we stand on the platform.
I can feel the warmth of his breath against my clavicle as he curses,
Tu me fais chier.
You could tell me to stay. Would you?
No. Which is why I've made it a point never to tell you anything, ma chère.
He snorts, and I feel his whiskers scrape my skin.
You are determined to do this?
Yes.
Then I won't try to stop you. Just come home, or I'll never forgive you, he says,
repeating what I told him not that long ago when he left for Alsace.
2 days from now, this will all be over and I will be home again. I promise.
Henri tucks my hair behind my ears. He kisses the tip of my nose and hands me my train ticket.
Here, I've reserved you a return seat on the Bordeaux train. Be on it, please. I don't know what I'll do if you don't step off that train on Sunday.
I set the return ticket in my purse and throw my arms around his neck.
Thank you. I love you. Kiss Picon for me. I know how lonely he is without Grenadine.
Not half as lonely as I am without you.
This is what our farewells have become of late. Desperate attempts to say everything in case we never have the chance again. It's like heaving my own heart into an open volcano. I am doing this to myself, to him. I am choosing a life that has me teetering on the edge of disaster.
The whistle blows, and I step back. I blow Henri a kiss and leave him standing at the ticket booth, looking at me as though he has opened a vein right there on the platform and his very lifeblood is draining away. I try not to feel guilty. I cannot feel guilty.
The life of my friend depends upon me. So I turn away, shake my head, clear my throat, and I step onto the train. Patrick O'Leary boards the train several hours later at Toulouse. I offer him a glance and a polite nod when he sits down across from me, but we do not speak or give any indication that we know each other. He's carrying a leather satchel which he tucks beneath his seat. Then he leans his head against the window and pretends to go to sleep. There are a handful of German officers sprinkled throughout the carriage, and they keep a watchful eye on the passengers, but harass no one. O'Leary leaves the train first at Agen, while I leisurely rearrange the contents of my purse. By the time I transfer trains and take my seat in the main carriage of the Périgueux train, O'Leary is sitting in the last row, back to the wall, his satchel on the floor beneath the seat next to him. I take that empty spot, but we don't speak until we've determined that none of the people in this carriage were on the last.
"Thank you for coming," I whisper in English.
"Wouldn't miss it for anything."
"Have you arranged a vehicle?"
"Yes," he says. "My radio man has borrowed one. He'll pick me up at the station in Bergerac, and we'll be waiting half a mile from the camp tomorrow after the changing of the guard. If all goes well, Garo will be in Spain this time next week."
"I don't think so."
"You don't think it's going to work?"
"Frankly," I say, "I hope he's still alive. He was all ribs the last time I saw him. He won't be able to make that trip over the mountains for weeks. He'll need to recuperate. He needs food, and a lot of it. He's lost 3 stone at least."
"I'll get him to Françoise. She'll fatten him up," O'Leary says. "You have the money?"
"Of course."
"Your husband?"
It's not exactly a question, more of a concern, and there are 50 different ways I could answer it, but none of them are O'Leary's business. So I say, "He is waiting for me at home."
"Well, thank God for that. I'd hate for him to come after me if this operation turns into a big Belgian backhander."
I've never heard this expression before. I turn to him, mouth open, about to ask, when he interrupts.
"You don't want to know.
But
just trust me."
"I'll figure it out eventually."
"I'm sure you will. But I'd rather not be around when you do."
For the second time today, O'Leary exits the train first, but his satchel is still under my seat, and I collect it before leaving the train and walking to the cafe where I am to meet Haylip. As I did a month ago, I visit the ladies' room first. And as O'Leary promised, a gently used guard's uniform is folded at the bottom of the satchel, along with a pair of socks and worn brown leather shoes. It occurs to me that I don't remember whether Garrow was wearing shoes when I last saw him. I was too concerned about his face, the hollows and bruises, to notice his feet. The reflection that greets me in the mirror betrays nothing of my inward state, namely fear and excitement and steely resolve. God have mercy on Haylip if he is trying to deceive or betray me, because I certainly won't. I pull 9 envelopes, the remaining 450,000 francs, from my purse and place them beneath the uniform. I splash a little cold water on my face to revive it from hours of travel. I brush my hair until it crackles and shines, then pull a brand new tube of lipstick from my purse. I take my time coloring my lips, paying special attention to the cupid's bow and the curve of my lower lip. I treat these seconds as a benediction. Once seated at a corner table farthest from the door, I pull Henri's old, worn copy of Les Misérables from my purse and try to read. Speaking French and reading French are different skills to start with. Reading road signs is one thing and Victor Hugo something else. But I am making progress, and I am sympathizing with Jean Valjean and the discomfort caused by his yellow passport when the chair across from me is pulled away from the table. Haylip is alone, and this is a small mercy because Henri made me bring a knife and I don't know how to use it. I spent most of the train ride aware of its presence at the bottom of my handbag, worried that I'd just end up with it turned back on me. My imagination wreaks havoc when let loose.
What does a stabbing feel like? Could I defend myself? How quickly would it take for me to die? These are the thoughts that consumed me during many of the long hours between Marseille and Bergerac.
"You came," Harelip says, and I see that he is genuinely surprised.
This makes me wonder how many takers he's had on this extortion ploy. "Of course. The man you're holding in Mozac is important to me."
"Your husband?"
"My cousin."
"Not likely."
I don't bother trying to convince Harelip of anything, but I do stare at him so long he grows uncomfortable and turns away to look out the window. From this angle, the scar on his lip is even more exaggerated, as though someone took a box cutter to his upper lip and stitched it back together with a safety pin. I am alarmed at the sudden wave of pity that I feel. What is it like to go through life as a disfigured man, as the sort of person others turn away from? Does he know friendship or love or intimacy or the safe embrace of a woman's arms? Merde, this is not what you are here for. Get a grip, Nancy, I scold myself. This man holds Ian Garrow's life in his hands. You cannot pity him.
I'd like to shake my head to center myself, but I don't. Control. That's what I must maintain. I sit still and I wait. Everything that happens going forward will be on his terms.
"Did you bring the items we agreed on?"
he asks. As an answer, I slide the satchel under the table until it rests between his feet.
"If I find anything out of order to a single franc, our deal is off."
"I always keep my word, monsieur. You'd best do the same." It occurs to me that I have never asked his real name.
"I will find your cousin tomorrow and tell him that the uniform will be left in the bathroom of barracks number 1, in the first stall, behind the toilet, 1 hour before the changing of the guard. One. I hope he is smart enough to remember that, because everything else is up to him."
Harelip does not look in the satchel to make sure our terms have been met. He grabs the bag and walks out the door without another word. I remain in my seat, staring at a chip in the tabletop, unwilling to drink my tea. I'm not sure what exactly the cafe brewed, but it tastes of old leaves and disappointment. I shove it aside and open my book once more. Patrick O'Leary pulls out the seat opposite me an hour later.
"Did you follow him?" I ask.
"Across the bridge to an old neighborhood. I lost him once he reached the statue of Cyrano de Bergerac at the Place de la Meurthe. He met no one, talked to no one. It looked as though he was headed home."
"Are we buggered?" I ask. "Do you think he's going to take the money and run?"
"One way to find out. Where are you staying?"
I give him the name of the cliffside inn where I stayed last time.
"Did you give him the address?"
"No. He didn't ask and I didn't volunteer the information."
"Then all we can do is wait and see. Go back to your inn and I'll call you there tomorrow, one way or another."
O'Leary shrugs.
"If you don't hear from me by 5 o'clock, run."
Bergerac, December 8th, 1942. I sit in the drawing room on the first floor of the inn and wait. Changing of the guard at Mozac happens at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I pick my nails. I cross my legs and swing my foot. I read Les Misérables, turning the pages for over an hour, absorbing not a single word. I know the words before me are epic, part of the canon of great literature, and yet nothing. Jean Valjean, candlesticks, Fantine, diseases, Cosette, Paris, gangs, murders, robbers, revolts. I see the lines that Henri thought particularly beautiful underlined in pencil. But none of it means anything. I may as well be reading about the history of mushrooms or cumulonimbus clouds. Les Misérables. I am miserable with all this waiting. What is taking so long? What is happening with Garrow? Did he get caught? Get shot? Is he even alive right now while I sit in this inn with a book in my lap? Are they coming for me? Will they send me to Mozac right along with Garrow? Does it even hold women?
Or will I be sent to Ravensbrück, where no friend will be able to rescue me?
Oh, the morbid places my mind can travel when fed a steady diet of fear for an afternoon.
4 o'clock. 4:13. 4:47. 5:05. 5:15. 5:18.
I'm not stupid. It's time to go. I've left my rented bicycle leaning against the garden fence behind the inn. I won't return to Bergerac. That's where they will be looking for me. I'll go east, toward Lalande, and catch the train there. I think about ways to disguise my appearance. I did not give Herr Lipp my name, but we've met twice, and he can pass on a good description. It's the hair and the eyes that give me away. I didn't bring a change of clothes, so I'll do what I can. I should probably purchase a wig if I'm able to make it back to Marseille alive. I stand, collect my purse, and take 3 steps toward the door of the inn, when the phone at the front desk rings. The innkeeper's daughter is pretty and silly and 15 years old. She answers the phone.
Allô?
A pause, and then her eyes lift to mine.
Mademoiselle Callier? Oui?
It's odd the way you can hear your own heart beating in a moment like this. I count 4 loud thumps, the blood pumping through my ears, before she holds the receiver toward me.
For you,
she says. I lean across the counter and set the receiver against my ear. There is only the slightest tremble in my voice as I say, Lucien Callier?
Nancy!
It is Ian Garrow's voice, choked with emotion, staticky and from a distance, but unmistakably his.
Thank you.
The innkeeper's daughter is looking at me, curiosity blooming in her light brown eyes.
Of course, I say. Get home safely.
I set the receiver down, adjust the shoulder strap on my purse, and bid the girl farewell. I am sweaty and panicked by the time I reach the train station in Lalande, but I arrive just as the whistle blows. I produce my papers and my ticket and take the first empty seat I can find.
Running late, mademoiselle?
I look up to see a middle-aged German officer staring at the bare ring finger of my left hand. His right earlobe is missing, as though it has been chewed off by some small toothy animal. I try not to smile at the sight, and I force myself not to hide my bare hand. I left my wedding ring with Henri because this is one of those trips where he cannot, under any circumstances, be implicated should I get caught. I brush a damp lock of hair off my forehead and give the brown shirt an embarrassed smile. I am always running late.
Such a pretty girl, he says with a tisk. Traveling alone? Where are you headed?
Can, I lie. His thin lips twist into a smile.
Pity. I'm only going so far as Marseille.
Why is that a pity?
I would have taken you to dinner.
Anyone who knows me would say the laugh I offer him is fake, but he doesn't seem to notice.
Do I not have a say?
About?
Whether or not we have dinner.
Haven't you heard? The officer asks.
What? We have taken Vichy. All of France is occupied now. You have no say in anything whatsoever.
Marseille, December 12, 1942. I am tired of shopping. It's a sport I've never much cared for in the first place, but a necessary one since returning to Marseille 4 days ago. I have gotten word from O'Leary that Ian Garrow was delivered to our safe house roughly the same time as my train arrived in Marseille, and I was careful to ensure that no one saw me anywhere near the camp in Morzac while in Bergerac. Yes, it can be argued that I was travelling on the same day that Garrow escaped, but I travel often, so that detail is not incriminating in and of itself. Still, I have made a deliberate effort to be seen out and about in Marseille a great deal the last few days. I have socialized, I have lunched, I have flitted about from one boutique to another, buying skirts and trousers and new underthings,
Henri and I had dinner with friends once and we have eaten out twice. It's all for show, of course. Harmless socialite is just one of the many personas I maintain these days. Knowing I have covered my tracks well does not stop me from jumping when someone pounds on the door of our flat. I look at Picon and his ears lie flat against his head. He growls. I go to the door and look through the peephole. Police Commissioner Paquet stands on the mat, glaring. He pounds again. He is alone, so I open the door. Monsieur Paquet! I lean on the doorframe and greet him with false enthusiasm.
May I come in?
My husband is not at home.
I've actually got a bit of news for you, madame.
Good or bad? I ask.
That depends.
On?
Where your loyalties lie.
Intrigued, I step away from the door and motion for him to enter. I lead him to the living room. He sits in Henri's favorite chair, and I pour us each a brandy. He takes his glass and sniffs with appreciation.
Merci.
What is this news you speak of, Commissioner?
Your cousin, Captain Garrow, has escaped from prison,
he says, watching me over the rim of his glass as he sips his brandy. Has he? Paquet's eyes narrow.
You seem to be quite pleased.
Of course I am. I don't even bother hiding my elation. It would only make me appear guilty. Wouldn't you be pleased if your cousin had been arrested for no reason, sent to prison, and then escaped? His mouth tightens. The effect is not complimentary toward his moustache.
I suppose I would.
I take a large swallow of brandy, then lean forward and tap my glass against his. Cheers to this bit of excellent news you've brought me, Commissioner. Paquet offers a rather unenthusiastic smile, finishes his brandy a bit more quickly than the vintage deserves, and excuses himself from my flat. The moment I hear his door close across the landing, I try to ring Henri at work, but there is a strange clicking noise, and then the line goes dead. I set the phone gently back in its cradle. I turn to Picon and say, "Well, I'll be buggered. They've tapped our home lines too."
Henri, March 1st, 1943. Henri steps onto the balcony as soon as Nancy leaves to run errands. She isn't traveling today. She's simply making her usual round of friends and shops. But two things happened yesterday that have him on edge. He hadn't meant to watch her leave the day before, but he noticed they'd left wine glasses on the balcony, and he went out to collect them. Then he paused to watch her cross the street because, God help him, the sight of her swaying hips still makes his mouth go dry. He'd intended to admire his wife for only a few seconds, and he's glad he did, or he wouldn't have noticed that man begin to follow her. He was nondescript. Henri can't remember a single thing about him, not face or hair or clothing, but he does remember that the moment his wife passed him at the bistro, he looked up. Henri couldn't blame him at first, not with that figure of hers, but then he finished his coffee in one gulp, stood, and followed her down the street. Then she turned a corner, and they were both out of sight within moments. He might have written the entire thing off as paranoia if he hadn't found someone going through their letterbox 5 minutes later. Henri usually leaves for work before sunrise, but they'd made love after breakfast, and he allowed himself the joy of holding her as the sun rose. He was late, and she left before him, and by the time he made it to the lobby, it was almost 9 o'clock. The man at their letterbox wore a hat, and his face was turned away, but there was something about him that seemed very German, very square. Henri is proud of the fact that he did not skip a step or call out to the man or show any signs of concern. He kept walking through the lobby and out the door, but the little hairs along the back of his neck stood up straight and remained that way until he was seated at his desk 15 minutes later. His wife is being followed. He might be as well, for all he knows. He never turned around to look yesterday. Their phones are tapped. Their mail is being intercepted. The Vichy Commissioner of Police is watching them. He stands on the balcony now, just inside the shadow cast by the overhang, and watches Nancy cross the street again. There are no men lingering on the corners or sitting outside the cafe as she strolls by, and he almost breathes a sigh of relief. Almost. But this time, it is a woman. He can see her reflection in the shop window, where she appears to be looking at a green feathered hat, and he can see her chin tilt to the right as Nancy passes. Henri counts to himself. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The woman turns and follows Nancy down the street. Fils de pute, he hisses. She is so far away that he can see nothing of her face, only that her hair has been shorn close to her head and she does not wear a hat. A collaborationist. Salope. Henri grinds his teeth. The woman is thin, but he cannot tell her age or height or whether she is attractive. He knows nothing other than the fact that she and the man who came before her is hunting his wife. They have run out of time. Henri has spent his entire adult life coordinating the logistics of a complicated shipping empire. He knows how to piece details together quickly, how to make arrangements. He calls Fistol at home. Now that the tram service is broken, his old friend has little to do other than be home with his wife, daughters, and dogs. Henri does his best to provide him with small jobs, anything really to give the man a source of income so he can feed his family. Henri, he says, delighted. How can I help you? The clicking in Henri's ear reminds him to be careful with his words. I need a piece of furniture moved to my office. Can you bring your cart to my flat in an hour? Oui, I'll be there. Buried under 27 sacks of flour in their spare room is the trunk that Henri and Nancy took on their honeymoon. He drags it into their bedroom and opens Nancy's closet. She has to leave. This is the thought that first began growing in his mind yesterday morning when his wife was followed. He tried to squash it at first, but it took root when he passed that man rifling through their mail, and it burst into full bloom the moment he saw that woman at the window turn after Nancy. She has to leave. Immediately. He packs her trunk because she will not have time to do this herself. Henri is careful. He pulls her favorite items from their hangers, folding them neatly and setting them into the trunk. Skirts, blouses, and slacks. A handful of dresses. A blue wool day dress with black buttons down the front, because he knows she likes it. A dressing gown, a winter coat, hats, gloves, scarves. Underclothes, but not her prettiest lingerie. That he keeps here with him, because he has to believe she will return, and he will have the chance to see it on her again. Stockings. Shoes. High heels mostly, but also one pair of hiking boots. Socks. He does put two satin nightgowns, one blue and one pink, into the trunk, because he knows that his wife believes in going to bed in the most feminine way possible. He'd rather she slept naked, but he can't argue the appeal of satin rubbing against his own bare skin. They never stay on her long, but Henri knows she would want to have them. He pulls the green cashmere sweater from the closet and begins to fold it, then hesitates and presses it against his face. He inhales that seductive scent so unique to his wife, juniper berries and jasmine and vanilla. It smells bright and warm and clean. He loves this sweater, He loves his wife in this sweater. Her body was made for cashmere. He tosses it onto his pillow instead of setting it in the trunk. He will ask forgiveness later. None of these things can travel with her, however. They will have to be shipped. So he grabs her second-best handbag from the closet and turns toward her jewelry case. Her engagement ring goes in first, zipped snugly inside an interior pocket, then the diamond eternity ring he gave her on their first anniversary, a watch with diamonds that circle the face. He never cared about diamonds until he met Nancy, but he likes the way they sparkle against her skin, and he'd bathe her in them if she'd let him. Her favorite little brooch, also diamonds, in the shape of a wire-haired terrier. He gave it to her the week after they lost Grenadine. 3 gold bracelets, 2 dinner rings, but no necklaces. Nancy rarely wears them, arguing that a good set of clavicles is far better adornment. He won't fight her on that point. And besides, he suspects her aversion has something to do with Marceline and that damn letter H. The majority of their cash is kept in his safe deposit box in Marseille. He does not have time to get there, however. Nancy will be home for lunch soon, and then he must send her away. But there are 20,000 francs at the bottom of his armoire, and he adds half of it to the contents of her purse, along with the set of papers declaring her to be Madame Fiocca, without the pesky details of her British heritage. And the other half he hides through the trunk in her clothing, waistbands and pockets mostly. He shoves a set of spare keys, apartment, his office, and safe deposit boxes to the bottom of the trunk in case she comes home. For one reckless moment, he considers stuffing Picon into the bag as well, but then he laughs. If he were to send everything she loves, he'd have to find a way to pack himself as well. He wants to go with her. He would give anything to go with her. But if the two of them were to approach the train station together, they would no doubt arouse the suspicion of every Gestapo officer in the city. No. He will send her first, and then he will follow later. Besides, there are other things he must arrange, other loose ends to tie. But for now, there is nothing left to pack. He drags the trunk into the living room, pours himself a double brandy, sits down, collects Picon into his lap, and waits.
Marseille, March 1st, 1943. I come home for lunch. This is the agreement we have made in recent weeks. If I am not traveling, we eat lunch together at home. There is this need to see and touch each other, to know the other is safe. There is nothing to be done about this fear while I am traveling for the resistance, but when I am home, neither of us can wait an entire workday. So I return to the flat at noon, breezing through the door, a greeting on the tip of my tongue, when I notice Henri is in the middle of the living room sitting on a large trunk. Picon is on his lap, and the look on his face tells me everything.
What's wrong? I whisper.
He shrugs, then says in a voice I can barely hear,
"They know. I don't know how, but they do. And you have to leave, right now. Yesterday I thought someone was following you, but today I'm sure. Yesterday it was a man. Today it was a woman."
This stuns me.
I didn't see anyone.
I did. Our phones have been tapped.
I know, we talked about that. We have a system.
And yesterday, I caught someone going through our mail.
Henri stands, takes 5 long strides across the floor, and pulls me into a crushing hug. He bends his mouth low to my ear.
I will send your trunk with Fistol, and he will ship it to Barcelona.
Henri!
I try to plead with him, but he cuts me off.
We have run out of time, ma chère.
His voice cracks.
This is the only way. Let me know when you get across the mountains. Promise me.
I promise. Where is your purse? He asks. I hold it up, only to see that my hand is shaking. Henri takes it and then returns to the trunk, where my other purse sits on the floor. He empties the contents of the one I've just handed him into the other.
I will join you in London as soon as it's safe.
Through all this, Picon has been standing at our feet, his little head swiveling back and forth, his body shaking. I pick him up and press my face into his neck. I scratch him between the ears. But he knows, and he begins to whine.
Shh, I tell him.
His whine becomes a series of loud, panicked barks, and Henri pulls him away from me.
You have to go now, he says.
Then adds,
if anything happens to me, you can go to the bank, the Société Marseillaise du Crédit. I have a safe deposit box set up in your name, and you will be well cared for.
I didn't realize I was crying until he said this. I wipe my face on my sleeve.
No. There is cash, gold, and bonds inside, he says, ignoring me. Roughly £60,000 in British currency. It's yours, and I will not touch it no matter what happens. Promise me you will collect it.
Henri!
Promise me, he hisses.
I am choking back sobs now.
I promise.
Shh. It is his turn to quiet me. Then he whispers,
call O'Leary from the train station. Tell him what's happened.
And now he has me by the elbow and is steering me toward the door. Henri hands me my second best purse, packed with who knows what. He kisses me firmly on the lips. There is nothing sensual about it. This is not the sort of kiss he would use to seduce me. This is an emotional kiss, urgent and terrified. The sort of kiss a man gives his wife when he's going off to war. But I am the one leaving. How am I supposed to leave? Picon is losing his mind now, howling and snapping at Henri to be let down. He tucks my sweet little dog into the crook of his arm so that neither of them will be hurt. Then Henri swings open our front door.
Have fun at lunch, he says,
his eyes flooded and his mouth trembling. I stare at him, stricken. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. The words, when they come, are not enough.
Back soon.